The Jewish Origins of Christianity. The following are excerpts from The White Man's Bible and Nature's Eternal Religion, both written by Ben Klassen. Though written from an atheist perspective, one can readily see truths concerning the hoax of Christianity. The trouble is, atheists are unaware of psychic powers and how they can be used to make people fall for this lie. About 100 BC, a small Jewish sect called the Essenes originated around the area of the Dead Sea. This sect promoted ideas of self-debasement that were highly suicidal to those who embraced this creed. Toward the end of the first century CE, this teaching evolved into Christianity, but still a purely Jewish cult. It was regarded as a subversive and destructive movement by the mainstream of the Jewish leaders and was opposed and persecuted by them. Among the persecutors of the Christian cult was one Saul of Tarsus, a Jew who later became Christianity's Saint Paul. One day, while persecuting Jewish Christians, he conceived the brilliant idea of humbling and destroying the mighty Roman Empire by selling his suicidal creed, Christianity, to the Gentiles. The idea was the most significant turning point in history. No plague, series of plagues, wars, or disasters during the next 2,000 years has wreaked more horrible calamity on the white race of the world than what happened next. So well did Saul of Tarsus do his job that he was soon joined and backed by the entire Jewish network in selling these suicidal teachings to the Romans. The Jews went about it with a vengeance, feeding the Romans such idiotic and self-destructive ideas as love your enemies, turn the other cheek, sell all thou hast and give it to the poor, resist not evil, judge not, and much other suicidal advice. To add to this, the Jews kept the ancient knowledge of mind power and energy manipulation and used this to further push the ludicrous Christian ideas on the Gentile peoples while all of the time working to remove this knowledge from the Gentile populace and cut us off from our gods. The Nazarene was invented to distract and nothing more. People put their faith in the idea of salvation through the Nazarene while forfeiting all of their own powers. Through generations, the Gentile soul has been stripped of all psychic power while those Jews and their Catholic Jesuit Gentile stooges at the top have kept theirs and the ancient knowledge that enabled them to use these powers to enslave the masses. That was my note, and I just want to add here that can all be found in their Kabbalah, the Jewish Kabbalah, but you've got to know a lot. I mean, you've really got to have occult knowledge. You've got to have total knowledge and of the workings of the mind and the soul, and you also have to know about words of power and everything else to understand it properly. Otherwise, it's taken literally. It's written in allegories. Okay, here we go. We'll get back to the article again. Christ never existed. Jesus Christ did not invent or found Christianity. All evidence that can be gleaned from scholarly examination of authentic history points to an obvious conclusion. There never was any Jesus Christ roaming about in 30 AD or thereabouts teaching a new religion. The whole story was invented and concocted much later. It was patched together out of fables, myths, bits, and pieces of other religions until finally they had a movement going that pulled in the Roman Emperor Constantine. It was this Roman Emperor who had the mind of a criminal. He murdered his own wife and son and thousands of others who in the year 313 AD really put Christianity into business. The Romans, who had always been extremely tolerant to all religions, excuse me, were now told by an edict of Emperor Constantine that Christianity was now the supreme religion of the empire to the exclusion of all others. The beginning of the Christian era found Rome near the height of her civilization. Her supremacy in the then known world was pretty much unchallenged. And it was the beginning of a long period of peace. To be specific, Pax Romana, Roman peace, lasted approximately 200 years beginning with the reign of Caesar Augustus. Rome was highly literate. There were many great writers, scholars, historians, sculptors, and painters, not to mention other outstanding men of philosophy and learning. Yet it is highly strange that despite the great commotion and fanfare that supposedly heralded the birth of Christ and also his crucifixion, according to the Bible, we find not a single historian nor a single writer of the era who found time to take note of it in their writings. Outside of the fabricated biblical writings, no Roman historian, no Roman writer, and no Roman playwright has left the slightest hint that he had the faintest awareness that the supposedly greatest of all greats was in their very midst and preaching what is claimed the greatest of all the new gospels. Whereas Caesar left voluminous writings that are still extant today and can be studied by our high school boys and girls, Christ himself, who had supposedly the greatest message to deliver posterity that the world has ever known, left not the slightest scrap of paper on which he had written a single word. This, in fact, the biblical literature itself confirms and mentions only that once he did write in the sand. Today we can still study Cicero's great orations and writings. He has left over 800 letters behind that we can study to this day. We can study whole books of what Marcus Aurelius wrote. We can study what Aristotle wrote, what Plato wrote, and scores of others wrote that were contemporary with the first beginning of the Christian era or preceded it. But strangely, there is not a word that is in writing that can be attributed to Jesus Christ himself. Furthermore, the Greeks and the Romans of that era, and even previously and afterwards, had developed the art of sculpturing to a fine state. We can find busts of Cicero, of Caesar, of Marcus Aurelius, and innumerable other Greek and Roman dignitaries and lesser lights, but nor one seemed to think it important enough to sculpture a likeness of Jesus Christ. And the reason, undoubtedly, is there was none to model at the time. There were undoubtedly numerous skilled artists and painters at that time, but again, strangely enough, none took the time or the interest to paint a likeness of this purportedly greatest of all teachers, who in fact was proclaimed the Son of God come to earth. But no painting was ever made of this man, who, we are told, gathered great multitudes around him and caused great consternation and even fear to King Herod of Judea himself. Now all of this is very, very strange if, as the Bible claims, the birth of Jesus Christ was ushered in with great fanfare and great proclamations. Angels proclaimed his birth. An exceedingly bright star pointed to his place of birth. In Matthew 2:3 it says, "When Herod the king had heard of these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him." We can hardly gather from this that no one was aware of the fact that the king of the Jews, the great Messiah, was born, for we are told in the preceding verse that the wise men came to Herod himself, saying, "Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and we are come to worship him." Evidently the event was even lit up with the bright star from heaven. In any case, King Herod, we are told in Matthew 3, was so worried that he sent the wise men to Bethlehem to search diligently for the young child, to bring it to him so he could undoubtedly have him put to death. As the story further unfolds, we learn that Joseph heard of this and quietly slipped out in the night, taking him with him his wife, the young child, and a donkey, and departed for Egypt. When Herod found out that he had been tricked, it says that he was exceedingly wroth, and sent forth and slew all children that were in Bethlehem and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under. Now this is a tremendously drastic act for a king to take, that is, to have murdered all the children in the land that were under 2 years of age. Again, we can hardly say that the birth of Jesus was unheralded, unannounced, and unobserved, according to the story in the Bible. However, it is very, very strange that this act of Herod, as drastic and criminally harsh as it is nowhere else recorded in the histories or writings of any of the other numerous writers of the times. All we have is the claims of those people who wrote the New Testament. In fact, whoever wrote the New Testament invented so many claims that are inconsistent with the facts that they even made a rather glaring error by pulling Herod into the story. History tells us that in the year 1 CE, when Christ was supposedly born, Herod had already been dead for 4 years. He could hardly have been disturbed or very wroth about the birth of anybody in the year 1 CE. There is further great evidence that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John never wrote any of those chapters that are supposedly attributed to them. What historical evidence can be dug up reveals that they were written much later, not at the time that Jesus supposedly said all those things, but somewhere around 30 to 50 years later by a person or persons unknown. Furthermore, when we compare the first four books of the Gospel with each other, which supposedly tell more or less the same story, we find that they contradict each other in so many details that one need only read them for himself to pick them out. I neither have the time, the space, nor the inclination to go into all these contradictions. They are too numerous. Still no Bible at 300 CE. At this time, the Christian movement, although purportedly nearly 300 years old, still did not have a written text or Bible. Under the powerful and dictatorial direction of Emperor Constantine, a convocation of church fathers was called at Nicaea, a town in Asia Minor. At this meeting, a number of scripts and writings were dragged together, and heated controversy ensued over a period of several months. Many writings were considered, discussed, argued over, and reviewed. Some were revised, some were rewritten, some were rejected. The final package that emerged from the Council of Nicaea was that was called the New Testament, a contradictory, demented conglomeration of far-out nonsense. To it was patched the Jewish Old Testament. The Christian movement now had a Bible, with Constantine as final arbiter. When the gathered bishops would or could not agree, he would threaten to bring in his army, which was standing by outside to enforce compliance. Ready to crush all opposition, Constantine exercised the full powers of his position, financially, militarily, and in terms of legal enforcement, to now promote Christianity and crush all opposition. Christianity was now on its way. Jews concocted Christianity. Where did the ideas of Christianity come from? The Jews, who were scattered throughout the Roman Empire, have been mastermind manipulators of other peoples from the earliest beginnings of their history. They have always been at war with the host peoples they have infested like a parasite. When during the Jewish Wars of 68 through 70 CE, Rome put down the Jewish rebellion in Judea and leveled Jerusalem to the ground, the Jews were thirsting for revenge. They were looking for a way to destroy Rome, the Roman race, and its total empire. They had tried military opposition and failed miserably, being no match for the superlative Romans. They looked for an alternative, mind manipulation through religion, and they found the right creed in a relatively unimportant religious sect called the Essenes. The Essenes. Nevertheless, the evidence is overwhelming that these ideas long preceded the Christian era, and it was not Christ who came out with them, but a Jewish sect called the Essenes who lived on the border of the Dead Sea. It was they who had already evolved the ideas contained in the Sermon on the Mount, but had been attributed to Christ. Not only had they evolved the same ideas as set forth in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but the wording, the phraseology, and the sentences were the same, and they preceded the supposed time of the Sermon on the Mount by anywhere from 50 to 150 years. The Essenes were a Jewish religious group living in approximately the 1st century BCE and the 1st century CE. We have important sources of their contemporary writings in the historian Josephus and also the philosopher Philo. They are also mentioned by various other Roman and Greek writers of those times, in which their religious teachings are revealed in considerable detail. However, in the last 20 years, the thousands of Dead Sea Scrolls, many of which were written by the Essenes themselves, reveal a tremendous amount of insight into the religious teachings, and above all, reveal that they preceded and preempted the Sermon on the Mount word for word, so that the so-called new teachings of a figure supposedly appearing from heaven in the year 1 CE and preaching during the years 3 to 33 CE were neither original nor were they new. Furthermore, we learned that the Essenes were notable for their communistic society, their extreme piety and purity, and their practice of celibacy. They possessed all the worldly goods in common and looked upon private property as an evil which might divert them from sanctity. They engaged in agriculture and handicrafts, considering these occupations less sinful than others. They also practiced baptism, and this practice preceded the Christian era by at least 100 years. So the Christian apostles can hardly be credited with having instituted the ritual baptism as is claimed. Why, the average reader might ask, haven't we been told more about the Essenes if they were the original practitioners of Christianity? There are two good and overriding answers for that. The Christians on their part, although the early Christian fathers were well aware of the Essene teachings and writings, took every measure possible to destroy them and purge them from circulation. The reason being they did not want their presence known because it would undermine their dogma that Christ was the originator of the new teaching. It would make impossible to claim that this was a great new revelation sent forth by God himself amid the hosannas and singing of angels. The Jews, on the other hand, did not want to reveal the presence of the Essenes because they wished to completely hide any connection between the Jews and their new religious teachings that they were about to administer to the Gentiles. They even went into great lengths to appear hostile to it. Before I go further into the highly illuminating and highly interesting Dead Sea Scrolls, I want to make just one further point, that is that the original manuscripts on which the New Testament supposedly based is always alluded to being translated from the original Greek. Since the New Testament repeats over and over and again that Paul spoke to his flock in Jewish and that Jesus spoke in Jewish and that the apostles were Jewish, why then is it that the manuscripts were all in Greek? The historical facts add up to this. The Jewish hierarchy and undoubtedly the whole conspiracy was well coordinated and had many, many members and co-workers. It was not written at the time of Christ at all, but the movement was given a great promotion by the combined efforts of the Jewish nation. As they organized and promoted their ideas further, these were reduced to writing considerably later than the years 30 to 33 CE, when Christ supposedly came out with these startling and new revelations. The conclusions that they were written by Jewish persons whose identity we shall never know, and were written by many authors, were revised from time to time, and not only in their original formation and formulation, but they have been revised time and time again throughout the centuries to become more effective and persuasive propaganda. However, we want to go further into the teachings of the Essenes and who they were and why their particular teachings were pounced upon by the Jews to be formulated into a well-distilled, poisonous brew and then fed to the Gentiles. The Dead Sea Scrolls, which are more numerous and more revealing than the Jewish press of today has informed us, tell us much about the teachings and the life of the Essenes. One of the most important things that they tell us about the Essenes is that they vanished from the face of the earth after about 2 centuries of existence, and the termination date being somewhere around the year 100 CE. They were, needless to say, only a very small sect of Jewish tribes and not a part of the Jewish conspiracy as such. Being outside of the mainstream of Jewish activity and thought, the Jews nevertheless observed from them that this kind of teaching could ruin and destroy a people. The Jews, looking for a way to destroy the Roman nation, who in the year 70 CE had destroyed and leveled Jerusalem to the ground, noted well what these teachings were and decided to perpetuate them on the Romans. Essenism was really a revolutionary new form of social order, an ideal cooperative commonwealth in miniature. Instead of the Messiah, the ideal of the Essenes was the teacher of righteousness. They established a new cooperative communitarian brotherhood where they were the first religious society to establish and observe the sacraments of baptism and the Eucharistic meal. Furthermore, the teacher of righteousness was promulgated by the Essenes may not have been the first pacifist in history, but he was the first to implement his pacifist theories with an overall practical measure which, if generally adopted, would abolish war. This, of course, was a wonderful religion for the Jews to sell to the Romans, for if they convert the Romans into submissive pacifists, they could certainly soon thereafter dominate them in full. And this they did. The Essenes lived in the area of Qumran, near the Dead Sea, and according to Philo, the Jewish philosopher and writer contemporary of that age, the Essene Brotherhood would not allow the manufacture of any weapons or allow within their community any maker of arrows, spears, swords, or any manufacturer of engines of war, nor any man occupied with a military avocation, nor even with peaceful practices which might be easily converted to mischief. Not only does Philo tell us about the Essenes, but also Josephus and Pliny, both contemporary historians, tell us much about the Essenes. As mentioned before, much is emerging also in the study of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The overriding fact that emerges from the study of the writings of the historians of that time and the Dead Sea Scrolls is this tremendously significant fact. Namely, that their beliefs, teachings, and practices attributed to Jesus Christ, although not exactly identical in all respects with those of the Essene school, were nevertheless closer to those of the Essenes than those of the bishops of the Ecumenical Council which determined the Nicene Creed of Orthodox Christianity. So we can come to the obvious conclusion that the Christian beliefs and doctrines, as supposedly enunciated by Christ in the Sermon on the Mount, did not originate at all at that time, but at least 100 years earlier from a Jewish sect called the Essenes living near the Dead Sea. That the elders of the Sanhedrin recognized this teaching as being deadly and suicidal, that they further took this doctrine and distilled and refined it into a working creed. The Jews then, with a great deal of energy and tremendous amounts of propaganda, in which they excel, promoted and distributed this poisonous doctrine among the Romans. Setting this creed down in writing is what is now called the New Testament, evolved over the next several centuries. It was written by persons unknown to us today, but undoubtedly of Jewish origin. Furthermore, to give it a mystical and heavenly sent deification, they invented the person of Jesus Christ and claimed that he was the Son of God. Then, having laid the groundwork for this new church, they consolidated that power at a meeting in Nicene, where the creation of the new church was solidified, the creed formalized and given official sanctification. Thus, in short, was launched the new church and the new religion of Jesus Christ, which was fabricated out of thin air. Not a single trace of the Jesus Christ personage can be found in authentic history. Nevertheless, this newly fabricated hoax of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, this idea, with all its suicidal doctrines, was soon to pull down in ruins the great Roman Empire and the great white civilization that went with it. Never again did the white race shake off the control of the Jews. Never again did the white man regain control of his own thinking, of his own religion, of his own finances, nor his own government. Unto this day, the white race has not regained control of its own destiny. Death of the Romans. We all know what happened to the Romans shortly after they were converted to Christianity. With their instincts deadened and their thinking perverted into worrying about the spooks in the sky instead of struggling for their own survival and advancement, they soon shrank into oblivion. They faded from the scene of history. They said the penalty of allowing themselves to be mongrelized and not recognizing... They paid the penalty of allowing themselves to be mongrelized and not recognizing their eternal enemy, the Jew. Such are the consequences of not recognizing your enemy, and, of course, you can't defend yourself against an enemy you can't or won't recognize. The Jewish Christian Bible is a mass of contradictions that has something to say positively and negatively on all sides of every issue. It is like a musical instrument. You can play on any tune you choose. By picking out those particular passages that suit your argument and ignoring all other passages that contradict it, you can have God and the Bible on your side to back up your argument, any argument, whatever it may be. As the Jews have pointed out often, They always first enlist the aid of the stupid preachers to help spread their corrosive ideas. The passages that were now emphasized were that we are all God's children, that we are all equal in the eyes of the Lord, that we all have a soul, that Jesus came to save all sinners, and a lot of similar drivel. The Jews are masters of argument. They capitalize in teaching argument tactics to their young in their yeshivas, Jewish religious schools. Okay, that's the end of my note. Back to the article. Infiltration of the Jews. At about this time, Rome itself was infiltrated by an alien people that were to prove more deadly, more treacherous, and more tenacious than the Carthaginians. According to a Jewish encyclopedia, the first accounts of Jewish settlement in Rome date to 139 BCE, but they undoubtedly were there much earlier. It states that Rome is the oldest continuous Jewish settlement in the world. Unlike the Carthaginians, the Jews were not a military threat, but more like an internal disease or virus. They undermined and sickened the whole body politic, culturally, economically, religiously, morally, and racially. Jews had racial religion. The answer to the question is this. The Jews then, as now, possessed a strong racial religion that they have rallied around their religion with race as the core for the last 5,000 years. We have already studied the importance of a racial religion in the previous chapter, and we have more to say about this in subsequent chapters. In their rebellion against the Romans, the Jews were utterly devastated militarily. They realized they could never match the Romans in a contest of arms. Dispersion. But they had a number of other factors going for them. Unlike Carthage, they were not congregated in a specific geographic area. In fact, they were dispersed all over the Roman world, specializing even then in the slave trade, in finance, and feeding on the trade routes. Then, as now, they covered all the nerve centers of power. The dispersion out of Jerusalem and Judea did not weaken, but only reinforced the Jewish infection on the lifelines of the Roman Empire. Planned revenge. Collectively, they planned revenge on the Romans, for whom they harbored an intense and pathological hatred. In fact, the Jews always hate that which is best for the Aryan race and instinctively set about to destroy the best. Since the Jews knew they had no chance of destroying the Romans militarily, they conspired to use their most powerful weapon, mind manipulation, and they chose religion as the vehicle to do it with. The Christian churches. Every creed and tenet that Christianity has espoused for the last 17 centuries has influenced our thinking towards downbreeding of our race. Christianity continuously and perpetually agitates against the fit and the competent and directs our interest and sympathy towards helping the halt, the lame, the blind, the poor in spirit, the morons, and the idiots by such teachings as blessed are the poor in spirit, morons, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The very idea that we are all equal in the eyes of an imaginary spook is just another rehash of the old Jewish equalitarian hoax all over again and must inevitably lead to race mixing. The white man's innate tendency towards compassion is the Achilles heel that has been his own worst enemy ever since Jewish Christianity conquered and destroyed the Romans. Whereas every other species in nature instinctively rejects and calls out the misfits, the white race stupidly does the exact opposite. Ancient Greeks practiced eugenics. The idea of eugenics is not new. The Spartans of ancient Greece back in the 5th century BCE were already aware of it and practiced much of what we are proposing today. Jews, supreme racists. Whereas all this race-mixing propaganda is aimed at the Gentiles, the Jews push a completely opposite line to their own people. The Jews, being yellow Semites, being racially aware and fanatically loyal to their own, preach racial aloofness to their own people. Through their synagogues, through their own Jewish press, through the thousands of exclusively Jewish organizations, they warn strongly against interracial marriages, against interfaith marriages. No race mixing for Jews. In short, the Jew, while viciously promoting the bastardization of the white race, fervently guards his own against it. In Israel, anyone not born of a Jewish mother is a goy, a non-Jew, an outsider, and can't be married or buried in Israel, nor can they become a citizen or enjoy any of the other civil rights of a born Jew. Racial solidarity is the order of the day, whether a Jew lives in Israel or anywhere else in the world. Okay, I just want to interject something here on my own. They changed that policy, I guess you have, nowadays. Okay, this was written like 40 years ago. Okay, nowadays a person or a Jew can get into Israel if they have a Jewish grandparent. Okay, the Jew carries the alien reptilian gene through the mother, which is recessive. The gargoyle-like features of Jewish celebrities Rodney Dangerfield, Larry King, Bela Abzug, Don Rickles, and many others are obvious. To be accepted among Orthodox, knowing Jews, one must have a Jewish mother. The genes do not match up, and the Jewish people are plagued by a host of rare diseases such as Tay-Sachs, Berger's disease, multiple sclerosis, and many others. The Jews themselves even admit there is a common gene they can all be traced to. It's called the Cohen gene. Okay, that was my note. Okay, now we're back to the article again. Mind police. Since the Jews for the last several thousand years have been carrying out the most vicious conspiracy in history, namely the destruction and takeover of all other peoples, they have been fanatic to the point of being paranoid about spying and gathering information on their enemies. And this is understandable. Since the hideous crime they are perpetrating is all based on secrecy and deceit, holding the lid on their conspiracy is a highly precarious business. So they frantically enter into all kinds of devices, spy organizations, and means of gathering intelligence that would stagger the limits of the Gentile mind. The Jews not only want to know what their enemies, everybody as their enemy, are doing, they also want to know what they might be planning. In fact, as far as possible, they want to know what everybody is thinking before such thinking might be translated into action. The ADL. The ADL, short for Anti-Defamation League, is in America. Ostensibly, it pretends to safeguard Jewish interests and prevent the spread of anti-Semitism. Why the Jews should find this necessary when the English, the Germans, the Italians, or other ethnic groups find such safeguards unnecessary, they have never explained. But in reality, the ADL is much, much more than that. Presumably, an offshoot of the Jewish B'nai B'rith, it is really the main powerhouse of this Jewish outfit. In reality, it is a powerful, well-financed spy operation inside our own borders that not only gathers information on politicians, civic organizations, diverse individuals, but on anything and everything that they so much as even suspect might blow the lid on the Jewish conspiracy. They have huge files on electronic computers that rival the FBI and the CIA itself, and any information the FBI or CIA might have that is considered useful to the ADL is readily fed to the latter. Censorship or operation. The ADL's activities extend much further. They are extremely active in politics, promoting those useful to the Jews and destroying those that might be deemed uncooperative. They also monitor all books, magazines, newspapers, all news media, movements or whatever, anything that might affect the Jewish conspiracy, and this includes just about anything of any significance that happens in this country. Plant propaganda. They aggressively invent, if necessary, news stories and plant them into the mainstream of the news media, TV, newspapers, etc. They not only publish a great number of articles for dissemination, but they also publish a large number of books that are either favorable to Israel and the Jews or viciously attack their enemies.